Hello and welcome to the Juan on Juan podcast. If you're enjoying the show, consider signing up for the Patreon. There you get ad-free content, early access, exclusive episodes, and monthly supporter hangouts. You can find it at patreon.com/the Juan on Juan podcast. If you don't like the subscription-based models, there are other ways of supporting the show that are linked in the description. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this episode.
They said it was forbidden. They said it was dangerous. They were right. Introducing the paranoid American homunculus owner's manual. Dive into the arcane, into the hidden corners of the occult. This isn't just a comic. It's a hidden tome of supernatural power. All original artwork illustrating the groundbreaking research of Juan Ayala, one of the only living homunculologists of our time. Learn how to summon your own homunculus, an enigma wrapped in the fabric of reality itself, their power at your fingertips, their existence, your secret. Explore the mysteries of the Aristotelian, the spiritual, the Paracelsian, the Crowleyan homunculus, ancient knowledge lost to time, now unearthed in this forbidden tale. This comic book holds truths not meant for the light of day, knowledge that was buried, feared, and shunned. Are you ready to uncover the hidden, the paranoid American homunculus owner's manual, not for the faint of heart? Available now from Paranoid American. Get your copy at tjojp.com or paranoidamerican.com today.
Welcome to the Juan on Juan podcast with your host, Juan Ayala.
Things that makes this thing so hard to track is again is you're dealing with sequences related to the number 7 and 77 and things like that. So I mean, you don't know if you're 14 weeks out or 14 years out, you know, or 7 weeks out or 7 days out. That's what sort of, you know, to be fair, that what makes this a little hard to track down. The only thing I would say is, you know, I've run some numbers on this and some, you know, little Pythagorean mathematics, maybe a little Kabbalistic magic. I would say keep an eye out for the day, for the 7 day period of June of 2026, spanning from about the 14th to the 21st. If I understand this death, I mean, nothing may happen, I don't know. But I think based on what I know about this thing, I think that's a time frame this thing will find irresistible. And I can't see this thing staying away from that 7 day period in June of 2026. That's when I would say this thing could rear its ugly head again. I don't know what it will be. I'd be speculating. Nothing could happen.
Welcome back to another episode of the Juan on Juan podcast. I'm your host as always, Juan. Make sure to follow the show on social media at the Juan on Juan podcast, tjojp.com, patreon.com/the Juan on Juan podcast. If you're on YouTube, Rumble, wherever, like, comment, subscribe, share the show. If you're listening to this on the RSS feed, make sure to leave a 5-star review, share it with family and friends. Appreciate all of you. And today we have Robert Sullivan with us, somebody who's work I've talked about before on the show. I did an alchemical breakdown of Star Wars, and I did read from your book, Robert, of the Monomyth. And welcome to the show for the first time.
Yeah, thank you, Juan, for having me on. It's my pleasure to be here.
And Robert, you have an interesting background. You've been on numerous podcasts before, but for those that haven't heard of you, where can they find your work and you've got how many books now?
I have 5 books on the market, and I'm working on several others. And these also include some re-editions, like 3rd editions of some of my earlier work.
Where can people find those?
Yeah, the books are available on all the major online retailers, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, Apple iBookstore. They're all available in the print form or the ebook, or the Kindle, the Nook, the ebook. Mm-hmm. Except for the work of fiction, A Pact with the Devil, the ebook of that will be coming in the next couple months. But all my books, are all available in printer, ebook, and again, all on all the major online retail sellers.
Awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about what got you started in this occult symbolism realm? Because this is something that, I don't know about you, but can you watch movies anymore without trying to pick it apart and see the occult behind it?
Yeah, I can. I can actually do that. I can watch a movie for just pure entertainment value, but I have to confess it is a little difficult. I almost inevitably find myself writing things down or taking notes. I decided to take a trip down memory lane, feeling a little nostalgic, and I was on this one show and we were talking a lot of horror movies, and I wanted to revisit Friday the 13th, the original one from 1980. And I got it on Blu-ray. I think it's the uncut version. And I was watching it. And I very much like the movie, regardless. But I, automatically just started noticing little things, little repetitions, little art of memory tricks. And of course, I have to start jotting notes down. But yeah, I pretty much can watch a movie just solely for entertainment value. But I do kind of also usually take some notes if I start seeing stuff, at least for later on. But no, I got involved with this at a very early age for me. And again, it goes back to the movie you've mentioned, Star Wars. I was born in 71. So this was a movie, a trilogy, that I grew up on. And, I was always, interested as a kid. It was sort of the ultimate movie. And it was years later, not too many years later, I think probably around the mid 80s, when I discovered that this story that Lucas was telling was coming out of the world of Joseph Campbell. And it was essentially a space opera based on ancient mythology. And that very much interested me. So I did some research. And of course, this is the Hero with a Thousand Faces book that I'm referring to. And when you read the book, you can clearly see where Lucas is drawing inspiration from. I mean, all the elements are there. All the characters are there. This is no state secret anymore. I mean, Lucas openly admits this. On the copy of the Heroes book that I have, I believe there's a testimonial by Lucas. So this was kind of, I guess, where the ball got, started rolling with the movie symbolism and iconography. And it spans all of Hollywood. It goes back in time. I can take it back to Tudor England with Christopher Marlowe and Shakespeare. Or you can find it in the 19th century American writers like Poe and Melville and Emily Dickinson and people like that. And I think it's a fascinating study, at least for me anyway.
Yeah, I find it truly fascinating. And we have Francis Ford, I think it's Coppola. I've always said Coppola. It wrong. Well, how do you say it?
Francis Ford Coppola.
Coppola. And he, one of my favorite, because I call him cinemagicians, one of my favorite quotes by him is, I think cinema, movies, and magic have always been closely associated. The very earliest people who made film were magicians. Now, I believe the way he's referring to that is magic with a C, I guess, right? Not the one with the K, more of like stage magicians, but even that has some sort of, ideology behind it, right? The tricking of the senses, if you will. And you mentioned Marlowe, you have, right, William Shakespeare, the world's a stage, every man and woman has their entrances and exits. And there's something about, right, the idea, and we call him George O. Fucus around these parts, instead of George Lucas, George O. Fucus. And the idea of creating this entire mythos, this entire universe, this entire existence that, again, he said he wrote it himself, but let's say it's a collaboration of people. But the idea of that existing in this higher dimension and then them manifesting that down into the medium that is film, that's got to do something psychologically to the masses. And that's magic in itself. That's a cult in itself, the way they were able to manifest that idea and then put it down and essentially have an entire role play or LARPing of the entire thing real time. And these movies, right, Star Wars, the franchise itself, has had a huge impact on culture and society.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things, you know, that I think you're spot on with is the idea, you know, of I mean, this again goes back to Shakespeare's plays and stuff like that, is the use of the archetypes, which are clearly manifestations of the subconscious mind, and how they can be, you know, I hate to use the word manipulated, but I guess that's one way to describe it at any rate. There are people who would disagree with that. You know, Giordano Bruno thought it was more of putting the person in touch with the divine. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to Hollywood, I was on another show, and, you know, Hollywood not only uses archetypes, they manufacture them. That is irrefutable. One of the great examples that I always give was, you know, ask anybody over a certain age, a Generation X or above, to speak like a vampire. I mean, inevitably, what are they going to try to do? Well, they're going to try to impersonate Bela Lugosi from Dracula. And of course, that's Hollywood magic at its finest. So, these movies are very potent forms of sorcery. They incorporate a lot of techniques, art of memory, psychological, occult. Films can be alchemical. I totally agree with that. It's without question, I think at any rate, one of the most potent, if not most powerful forms of media ever created. And you get into it with television, music, videos. I mean, you know, it's a broad subject.
One of the things that always interested me was that I found really, really fascinating was, right, this Hollywood pantheon, if you will, that they came up with. And they came up with this pantheon, right? You have the werewolf, you have the white zombie, you have King Kong, you have Dracula. All these movies have something in common, that some of the greatest hits all came out during the Great Depression.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the thing I found interesting about that's like the state of the union, I guess, for lack of a better term, of the country at that point was one of the worst. But then they brought forth some of the greatest hits ever. And it was because these theaters, it was a form of escapism for these people. They were going to these caves, right? These dark places, going in there and being subjected to wherever these movies, the cinema was taking them. So their consciousness essentially was being transported to somewhere else, and they could escape the reality that they were actually living in, which was probably horrible to live during that time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the idea of the horror movie, with Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, clearly geared towards Depression era audiences, is, you know, you're sort of conjuring something that's more terrifying than the reality that they're in. And you find this along the lines also in World War II. You will constantly find these escapist movies that, I always think of the ones that I always turn to that was completely geared towards the World War II audience was the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce Sherlock Holmes series from the 1940s. Those are pure escapism and were completely geared for the World War II audience. So, yeah, I mean, Hollywood, the timing of the film, I get into in the last book I did, and I'm going into this again in the new book, is, of course, The Exorcist. The timing of that movie is completely synchronized to be pulling you out of the 60s and putting you into the 70s. So, yeah, I mean, that's, there's a lot of, when it comes to cinema, there really is this huge, overly large palette that these wizards paint with. When I talk about symbolism, yeah, I mean, it's symbolism, but I mean, it can be costuming, it can be music, it could be the very actor or actress that is cast in a part can have some sort of occult meaning. So it's very broad, and I've even documented times where the release of the movie, the date that is chosen, has some sort of occult meaning of some kind, as above, so below, as it were. So, yeah, very, very potent and very powerful stuff.
And speaking, I know you wanted to talk about, we have here, let me pull up the, you have The Curse of Aleister Crowley, Rainbow Oz, the Killings, and you mentioned The Exorcist, and if I recall correctly, that was also a movie set, I guess, that was covered in being cursed because they were supposedly invoking Pazuzu or something. And a lot of the people that were involved with that movie either passed away or something. Am I correct on that? Have you ever heard anything of that?
there were some problems on the set with The Exorcist. I don't recall if anyone died or anything like that. But I mean, certainly that is obviously a very, very bleak film, to say the least. And the whole I mean, there's a lot of symbolism in that movie regardless. I mean, there is an entire interplay of light against dark in that movie. It begins in the summer in the heat, ends in the frigid cold. You have the Charis figure as clearly as the Christ archetype. You have a lot of Neoplatonic imagery where it's tied to the reign of darkness with the demon is tied to the weather, the death of the sun. Kubrick plays around with this also in The Shining. So you have a lot going on in The Exorcist. But then you have this whole idea where Blatty, the guy who wrote the novel, used to work for the CIA. And the movie is essentially a mind control operation, basically designed to subdue the counterculture radicalism of the 1960s and usher in this more decadent era of the 1970s. And it clearly worked. You know, the Jesuits, the two Jesuit priests represent the authority of the state over the populace. The demon represents the counterculture movement, the sort of anti-establishment. And the casting out of the demon is the authority of the estate to smash the people. So the Exorcist is this whole examination, a psychological examination of the power of the state over the people. And that's, I think, a very interesting study. There's something I talk about in Cinema Symbolism 3, and I'm delving into again with CS4. The stuff with the Wizard of Oz and Crowley is really, really interesting. It's a long story. I don't mind talking about it a bit, but that's something I'm researching right now. But the stuff with that is just amazing.
Yeah, I'd like for you to get into that, because this idea of cursed movie sets, I've been told before that certain people won't watch. Like my wife, she doesn't watch certain horror movies because she believes that, you know, if you subject yourself to that sort of thing, you can open up your mind to certain aspects, which I know I've heard you say before, you don't believe movies can sort of affect people's reality. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but again, they're alchemical in nature, because obviously alchemy is also the manipulation of symbols figuratively and literally. I mean, the manipulation of matter itself, practical alchemy, and then how Manly P. Hall says, the alchemist is working on four different dimensions, right, simultaneously to achieve the magnum opus. And I mean, they're doing all that because they're layering, right? The actor is a person, the character that they're playing is another person, then the character being portrayed on the screen is another one. So they're laying all these realities on top, and you have shows on Netflix that even show this, like the Black Mirror, as of recently, the first episode where they're talking about like the seed reality, right? The original reality. And then the reality is built on top of that, and how, you know, they put this out there, but Robert, what are your thoughts on it being used to, like, cause alchemy at the end of the day is all about bringing forth this change and manipulating and transmuting reality itself. Do you think these movies at all have anything much deeper to them, or are they just art? And they're just
The movie itself, there is a section of alchemical films, and you can look at them two ways. You can look at them as the movies, and these are the rarer ones where you actually have the idea of the actual alchemy of turning base metal into gold. They're few and far between. The only one that really jumps off the top of my head, the main one of them all, is Goldfinger. And of course, this is where the villain is trying to transmute the gold in Fort Knox to make it worthless, to make his gold supply worth more money. So that's actual physical alchemy. And he's got the dirty bomb, which is the philosopher's stone. And one of the things that's always pervasive in these alchemical films is this color scheme that denotes the four phases of alchemy, the albedo, the rubedo, the citronatus, and the negredo, the blackening, the moon, the sun, and the finality of the magnum opus, the red. When you see an alchemical movie, those color schemes almost inevitably turn up. But the alchemical films that usually are much more, out there is where you have what I call the transition of the self movie. This is where the character, usually the protagonist, or at least one of them, starts as something at the beginning of the movie and then winds up you know, as something completely different by the end of the movie, and they go through a change, a transition. Most of the time it's psychological, but you do get the rare instance where it's both, or the physical one, you know, where it's a physical transmutation. The movie that comes to mind for that is Black Swan with Natalie Portman, where she, at the end of the movie, is actually this horrid, demonic, bird-like creature. And of course, you can think of The Shining with Kubrick, where Torrance, Jack Torrance, starts off as a kind of this failed writer, failed father, and by the end of it, he's undergone this change and is this psychopathic murderer. So there's those type of movies, which are highly alchemical. And then you get into the idea of, you know, can the movie affect reality? I mean, sure it can. I mean, look at the example we just gave with The Exorcist. Like you mentioned, you know, look at the Star Wars phenomenon. I mean, you know, the movies are pop culture and vice versa. So, you know, they can have a tremendous influence on society, you know, one way or the other. Look at Star Wars now. I mean, we have the whole day dedicated to it. May the 4th, May the Force Be With You Day. If that's not a cultural impact, I don't know what is. And like I said, ask anybody over the age of 40 to speak like a vampire. I mean, that comes straight out of Hollywood. I mean, that's the Lugosi Dracula movie. So, yeah, I mean, can movies affect reality? Of course. I mean, you know, that's part of their modus operandi as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm on board with you, and I always talk about interdimensional literature, like these books that have affected whole entire sections of history, right? Hundreds and thousands of years sometimes. And I think movies are sort of books, right, that are just in a different sort of medium. You have the script, and you keep saying casting, right? Like you're casting a sort of spell. You have usually a cast of members. And so let's get into this Oz, because like I said, I've been reading Fritz Springmeier, and he goes hard on, he's got like an entire section where he talks about the Wizard of Oz, and I've always found that super interesting. I actually have never watched the movies. I'll be 100%. I've never watched the movies, but I've seen enough. You know, my wife's a big fan of it, and she's seen it a few times, but I've never actually sat down and watched the movies. And I know there's numerous books that a lot of people don't really cover. There's like over 10 books, isn't there?
So it's 14 books.
14 books.
Yeah, that's seven doubled. That's very critical to this.
Yeah, the seventh son of a seventh son.
Yeah, it from what I can tell, I'm researching this now, there looks like there was some sort of killing curse put down by Native Americans against L. Frank Baum. And this hex somehow did not go after him or his family, although it looks like it caught up to one of his sons later on. But somehow or another, this curse attached itself to his books. And from what I can tell, this hex doesn't become active until 1939, when this thing is being turned into a movie. And you have all sorts of disasters on this set. But there's some aspects of this thing that are really striking. And I don't know how this has happened. It's some sort of magical osmosis or what have you, because my initial thought was that Aleister Crowley was behind this. I don't think that to be the case anymore. But if you know anything about The Wizard of Oz, and I can certainly explain it, in Aleister Crowley's Kubala, and this ties into, like I said, it's a long story. I'll try to condense this as best I can. It has to do with this thing that contacted him in 1904 called AWAS that predicted this new age of Horus. And Crowley dedicates the rest of his life trying to explain this to people, what this new age means. And he comes up with a system of Kubala and numbers. And one of the things he says in his works is, he says that the god Horus, it appears as this god named Heruraha. And this is the new manifestation of Horus. But then he later says in book four, he says, this thing turns into the goat of Mendes. This is Baphomet. This is the god of the Knights Templar. He said, this is essentially the god of this new age of Horus. Well, if you know anything about the Platonic year and of the precession of the equinoxes, he's talking about the age of Aquarius here. And what the age of Horus, the Aeon of Horus, and the age of Aquarius run parallel. They're the same things. But then what he does is he gives these number designations. And he says, when these numbers start popping up, this is a designator, a road sign that this age of Horus is here. And then he lays down, and in his work, he gets into this killing curse number. They're two separate numbers. The one number, he says, the goat of Mendes's number is 77. And that's Oz, O-Z. And he gets into how he comes up with that. He says, when you start seeing this number turning up, this is when this god is on his way, is coming. And the other number is 42. This is his killing curse number. This is the grand number of the curse. And of course, both these numbers are the Wizard of Oz. So somehow or another, this killing curse has latched on to this movie and is being carried forward in time. And whenever you see these tragedies strike, these numbers 77 and 42 are always there. They're always present. And it ties into two things. It ties into this announcement of this new age of Horus, 77, the goat of Mendes. And it ties into this dark mother. Crowley calls the number 42, it's the dark mother. That's the exact word Crowley uses to describe it as. And it's some sort of very vicious, cruel killing number that these two things work in tandem, because whenever you see the number 77, the number 42 is always buried in there. It's a little harder to find. 77 jumps off the page. You can see that pretty easily. But you move forward from 1939, when you look at these tragedies, you will constantly find these numbers, 77 and 42, all over the damn place. And it, to me, is this curse manifesting two ways. It's both announcing this new age of Crowley, this new god of Crowley, this goat of Mendes, but it's also destroying things. It's basically plowing the way by being very destructive. Crowley says that he says it in the Book of the Law. He says it's a god of vengeance and war. So these two numbers seem to appear, or they do appear in a lot of tragedies, but they hide. And again, this is something I'm looking at right now. I don't believe this is man-made. I believe the curse is man-made, but I don't think these images or these numbers are being implanted by humans. I don't see how that would be possible. Despite everything I just said, the thing that makes this study the most interesting is its most macabre aspect. And believe me, when I say macabre, I mean macabre. I mean, because this is utterly morbid, and it sends shivers down your spine when you examine it. It does mine anyway when I'm doing this. Buried in all this bloodshed, in all these tragedies, I mean, the more children that are killed, the more bodies that are burnt, the more people that are die, there will always be some sort of allusion, citation, reference, a lot of times visual, to the Wizard of Oz. And that is by far the most interesting aspect of doing this, but it's also by far its most macabre. So I'm convinced that this is happening. I've seen too much evidence of it. I'm still trying to put together how this curse was, you know, created, generated. My original reaction to this was that this was Crowley, but I have loads of stuff here on Crowley. I have books that he wrote. I have all the books that he wrote. I have loads of books about Crowley, and there is no mention anywhere in the literature of the Wizard of Oz that he had some sort of bone to pick, or that he didn't like it, or this, that, and the other. So my research led me back to Baum, the guy who wrote it. And what I discovered about him was that after the Battle of Wounded Knee, he called for the genocide of Native Americans. He said that basically every Native American man, woman, and child should be lined up against the wall and shot. So I thought, okay, now I've got motivation here. Now I've got, I've got some motivation here. And again, I think this was some sort of Native American curse that has gone through some sort of bizarre osmosis, probably from the early 20th century up until 1939, where it didn't go after Baum. It attached itself to his books. But in book form, this thing seems to be dormant. And this thing starts picking up in 1939. I can tell you a couple things about this curse because I've been examining it the last 6 months. It's a timing sequencer. It always moves in numeric sequence, and its numbers are 7, 77, 7, 77, and 42. Those numbers must be present. If they are not present, this thing has nothing to do with it. Those numbers will be present on the incident, and there will always be some sort of lead up regarding those numbers to the next event. That always seems to happen. And it can be what makes this incredibly a difficult study is the other numbers that you'll see turning up are like 49, which is 7 squared, you know, 7 times 7. So it can hide in like multiples and divisors of these numbers. But, you know, this to me, despite all the Masonic stuff I've looked at, despite all the symbolism in movies and Jung and Campbell and Black Swan and The Shining and repetition, in my opinion, this killing curse takes the cake. I mean, because I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything where these numbers are just so pervasive. I mean, they're just all over the place. And it's just one event after another, and they just move to it. It's like the string of numbers just keeps moving along at these intervals of 7, 77, 7, 7, 7, and 42. And I can give you some examples if you want. I mean, I've got, you know, a lot written on this. I might have to pull something up here, but, you know, I certainly can go further if you want me to. But again, this is something that I'm working on right now for Cinema Symbolism 4. And I can tell you and the audience that this book has gone kind of in a completely different direction than I first anticipated.
So almost like this numerical parasite type of thing. Now, do you think that there are multiples of these? Because, I mean, we can see numbers, and it just makes me think of Pythagoreanism where, right, they worship number and how reality is right. All is number, is how Pythagoras said. Right. Do you think there's numerous of these? Is it like an entity or like what do you like a Wendigo or like a Skinwalker type of thing going around?
It's when I first my initial reaction when I was put onto this with these numbers was I thought I was looking at a computer program, but I dismissed that pretty quickly because there doesn't seem to be any evidence of this prior to 1939. It's 39 afterwards. I don't know if it's a Skinwalker or a Wendigo. It's a killing curse. And it strikes with these numbers. And one of the ways I try to describe it is it's like watching a lottery drawing a lot of times. It's one ball, one thing has to come up, and then another thing has to come up, and then another thing has to come up. And then if a fourth thing comes up, it strikes. And like I said, it revolves around these four sets of numbers. And when you look, when you examine an incident, I mean, we'll take 9/11, for example. Those numbers are all over the place. I mean, and it feels like a program or a code. And you can, you know, when you look at those numbers, then you can start finding Crowley's other numbers. But if we just stick to like 77 and 7 and 42, you know, you will find those numbers in Columbine. You'll find them in the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. You'll find them in 9/11. You'll find them in the Kennedy assassination. They hover around Helter Skelter with Charles Manson. All these negative events produce these numbers. And like I said, it's some sort of killing curse, in my opinion, that is making its run. And I don't see that it's inactive. From what I can tell, this thing is still activated. It clearly goes beyond 9/11, which I would describe as sort of the main event to this whole thing. This is sort of like the event horizon where, you know, the age of Horus is officially here and the age of Pisces is history. But it moves on. It continues on after 9/11. I mean, you will clearly find it, you know, in the, you know, 7/7 attacks in London. You'll find it with the Virginia Tech shooter. So it goes beyond 9/11. And again, one of the things, not often, you know, those numbers will always be there and it takes a little while to find it. But again, the most macabre aspect of this thing is there will always be this allusion to the Wizard of Oz in there in all of this. So, you know, that's what I'm examining right now. I don't know if it's a Skinwalker or a Wendigo. I call it a death hex or a killing curse. That's the way I describe it. But like I said, you know, all the other stuff I've looked at aside, this thing takes the cake.
Because we see the numbers 33 a lot, right? And a lot of these events that happen in the mainstream media, You have the number 11, right? So that's why I asked if you think that there's maybe multiples of this or if this is a sort of technology, because I know gematria is really important for these occultists, and they use number as a sort of talisman, right? They put it in their name, they put it in everything that they do. I'm sure you're aware of that. So again, sure. I've never had it interpreted to me in the way that you're doing, almost like a, right, execute order 66, if you will, like in Star Wars, and then everything, you know, flips on its head.
Well, the thing that I would say is, if you read Crowley's, Aleister Crowley's Kubbalah, he gives you a string of numbers. And he said, these are the new numbers for the new age. And he uses some numbers and he tosses out some numbers. One of the numbers he tosses out is 33. He said that number is defunct in the age of Horus. Forget about it. The important numbers are, you know, 77. And again, 9 and 11 are big numbers. And again, you can find these, you know, the four numbers I mentioned are really the biggies. But, you know, when you get in the 9-11, you can look at Crowley. You can see what he says about number 9. That's important. You can see what he says about the number 11. That's important. One of the numbers that's also very important that ties into this is the number 4. We had 4 aircraft on 9-11. We had 4 bombers on 7-7 in London. There were 4 pairs of ruby slippers, things like that. And if you read Crowley, he said this is the magician's. The number 4 is the number of the magician's evil weapons. That's his exact description of it. So, the other numbers are very important. I'm not saying they're not, but it's really the sequence of 777, and 42. And again, if you read Crowley, 42 is the death number. That's the grand killing curse number. And of course, that's the rainbow. And the Wizard of Oz is, of course, the most famous song is Over the Rainbow. Over the Rainbow in gematria has a value. I think it either Pythagorean or reverse Pythagorean reductions. There's different ways to do gematria. Has a number of 77. The Wizard of Oz, the value 77. So again, these are numbers that come up over and over again. But the thing that I can tell you pointedly is these are not being encoded by human beings. This is a supernatural event because human beings can't operate like this. I mean, the CIA doesn't sit there and can the CIA determine how many firefighters die battling the blazes on the Twin Towers on 9/11? Can the CIA determine how long Flight 77 stays airborne? Can the CIA determine how many U.S. servicemen, midshipmen die in the Pentagon? I mean, those are numbers that are beyond any human's control. So, though, that to me strikes me as a supernatural event. Sure, you can get into, you know, maybe some of these jihadists were CIA assets, you know, with the CIA involved with the Kennedy assassination. Sure, I'll go along with that all day long. But what I'm pointing out is there is this very dark, demonic, supernatural undercurrent with these events that is guiding these things. And that's where I'm at right now with this.
So, and Lieber Oz here, I'm checking on occultdeco.com, made by a friend of mine. Lieber Oz is in Latin is 666, and in Trigamaton, I guess, Kabbalah, I've never heard of that one, is 77. You also,
but Oz is 77. Oz is the goat of Mendez. That's Oz and the goat of Mendez.
77 right there, yeah.
Or 77. That's the god of the new age. He tells you that point blank.
And do you believe that maybe there's people who can, all right, so you have some factors that you can't account for, that you can't predict. But do you think maybe there are some people, right, in these higher ups, right, the people that they like to call the Illuminati or whoever they are, right, a group, right, the shadow people, that can maybe that they're aware of this and they're able to predict when something's going to happen based on, again, the numerical alignment? Because I think this is, you know, you have people like John Dee, who I've always said, and I'm working on this, and this is a theory I'm working on, where he was at the forefront really with Mercator and all these guys for the longitude and latitude system. Right? You have latitude 33, you have all these different ley lines and these energy, these dragon lines. And what if, again, this grid that they put around the world was sort of magically charged in some sort of talismanic way. And these wizards, again, similar to you mentioned the art of memory and the memory theater. Well, the idea that you're able to tap into the model, right, into the energy from the model, from a simulacra of the bigger area, you know, by, again, the magician, it's remote viewing. It's what they show in Stranger Things and all these other shows. Do you think maybe there's some people out there who can predict this numerical hex, the killing?
What I tried to do it. So what I did was, knowing what I know about the way this curse works, I try. Well, here's my problem with this, with what kind of you're saying is, I don't dispute the fact that there's, like, you know, the CIA was involved with Kennedy and maybe 9/11 and stuff like that. But the problem I have is, this hex did in Kobe Bryant. This hex killed Carrie Fisher. And I can't come up with a reason why they would want those people dead. But their numbers are no good. Kobe Bryant's numbers are atrocious. I mean, it's the one of the worst. He has one of the worst numbering sequences I've ever seen. I mean, he really played with fire with this thing. So what I did was, what I've been doing now is, and it's funny you bring this up, is based on my knowledge of this curse and the way it operates, I started looking at celebrities and I started looking at their numbering sequences and I started seeing, you know, who has bad ones and who has good ones, or who has none whatsoever. So I went to, you know, a couple of celebrities, you know, that I grew up with. I was born in 71. I looked at Madonna's. Hers wasn't great, but it didn't make me sit up in my chair. I think I looked at Keanu Reeves. Again, not great, but nothing alarming. I looked at Sandra Bullock's. Hers are bad. And as I was, it was funny because on the very day I was looking Sandra Bullock up, because she was in it with Speed, with Keanu. Her boyfriend has just died. And on the same day, that was the day that the Michael Orr lawsuit was announced against the Tua family. And that was when she won the Oscar for playing, I think it was Leanne Tua in the Blind Side movie. And people were online calling for her to give the Oscar back. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, well, maybe this is it. You know, maybe this is the hex getting her, you know, by killing her boyfriend and this problems that's having. This could be it for her. The only artist right now, the only person I could tell you whose numbers suck, I mean, are atrocious, is Taylor Swift. She is, I mean, like I said, I don't have a crystal ball here. I'm not wishing anybody any harm, but I'm not liking what I'm seeing at all with her. You know, listen, she could live to be 95 for all I know, and I hope she does. But, you know, based on what I'm seeing with this thing, she's playing with a little fire right now. And, like I said, the one thing that the way this thing seems to work is it's like watching a lottery drawing. It's one number, something has to hit, then something else has to hit, then something else has to hit, then something else has to hit. Then on that fifth day, if something hits, you're in trouble. And that's the way I can kind of describe this, you know, playing out. So, you know, I've tried doing it. I mean, like I said, I don't consider myself a psychic or a soothsayer or anything like that, but I have kind of, knowing what I think I know about this curse, you know, looking forward, you know, can I maybe see the divine something in, and you know, out of some of the celebrities I've looked at, you know, her numbers weren't the best. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, and you had that whole amnesia. There's people who were having amnesia at her concerts recently, where people would go and they were just forgetting everything, which is weird.
Yeah.
And then do you have anything on Travis Scott? Because I know he's kind of, you know, speaking of cursed films, he came out with this, right? We know what happened with him at the Astroworld concert and all these different things. And it seems that every time he has a concert, people get hurt. But he was supposed to do that concert at the Pyramids of Giza. That ended up getting canceled because supposedly the officials didn't agree with something along the religious beliefs or something or other. But he has a film that's coming out with A24, the A24 production company.
Sure.
And I've been told before that those movies are cursed, and they have that really, really creepy movie Hereditary, where it's about invoking, right, Paimon, this prince of hell, into a human, right? And they do the whole thing. I mean, that movie's crazy, but the idea, again, this is all LARPing in a sort of way, right? These people are doing that, and the people, when they were writing that movie, they were taking from actual grimoires and putting things together for specifically for that movie. So they were literally getting different lines from different grimoires on the lure of this Paimon and putting it together in the movie. And I mean, they talk about it.
That carries forward. That's interesting, because Hereditary is a movie I'm taking on in Cinema Symbolism 4. I haven't seen Ari Aster's latest movie, which I think is called Beau is Afraid. I haven't seen that yet. But what's interesting about the whole thing with Hereditary and Paimon is the Hereditary movie draws a lot from The Exorcist. There's a lot of imagery from The Exorcist that he implants in that movie. And of course, both movies are about demonic possession, so it makes sense. Aster loves foreshadowing stuff. That's his big kick. He loves using little techniques to foreshadow what's going to happen in the movie, you know, 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, a half an hour ahead. And you get that in The Exorcist too. There's a technique that that Friedkin uses in The Exorcist. It's one of the best foreshadows in all of movies, that he uses in, The Exorcist, and Aster plays into that. I always felt that Aster's second movie, Midsommar, was highly demonic. I thought that was as creepy as. And of course, you have the invocation of payment in that one. Well, the whole Midsommar movie revolves around the number 9. If you pay attention to it, the 9 is invoked all over the place in that movie. It has two meanings. The number 9 is, of course, a key number in Norse mythology, and of course it's set in you know the wherever it was, Sweden, and you know the Norse mythology with Midsommar. So number 9 is all over the place regarding Norse mythology, but of course in Ars Goetia, the Lesser Key of Solomon, Paimon is the 9th demon. So you got to continue on the invocation into Midsommar with the human sacrifice at the end, which is really sort of, to me, is continuing the story of the invocation of Paimon.
Wow, and that's crazy, because again, if we are hinting at that movies are used as a sort of manifestation device, what a creepy thing to do, where you continue the same. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. The chosen one. Yes, he is the chosen one. He's got his own comic, and now he's got his own song. 'Cause he's the chosen one. Yes, he is the chosen one. Go buy a copy at ChosenOne.com. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. It's easy to remember if you just sing along. ChosenOne.com. Go visit ChosenOne.com. Same sort of invocation, if you will, right? In a series. You know, consecutively, because Midsommar did come out before, right? That was the movie that came out before.
No, it comes out after Hereditary. It
came out after Hereditary?
Yeah, Hereditary, I think, was 17, and Midsommar is 19, I think.
2019. Dang, Hereditary is kind of old. I didn't know it was that old. Yeah, it's 2018,
But like, when you go back and watch Midsommar, you're going to want to pay attention to the number 9 in it, because that's pervasive. I mean, it's hidden, but it's in there. I mean, one of the things, from the very beginning of it, when Danny, by the way, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, Midsommar is a retelling of The Wizard of Oz. I mean, you have the girl going to the magical land with the three travelers, same sort of, you know, themes going on. It's only much darker. Danny has her Gnostic epiphany, you know, where she realizes she's a death dealer. Dorothy has her Gnostic epiphany at the end of the Wizard of Oz. You know, Danny, Dorothy, same thing. But when you watch, like the one that I just recall, when you watch Midsommar at the very beginning of it, when Danny calls her parents' house, her message is the 9th message. And again, when you watch it, try to keep your eye out for the number nine, because it's very pervasive. The number nine is critical in Norse mythology, so it does have a meaning there. But again, it's Paimon, it's the ninth demon, continuing one from Hereditary. I'm convinced of that.
Wow. Yeah. And are they coming out with any more movie? I know that they're gonna produce Travis Scott's. They're doing a collaboration with Travis Scott. And
yeah, I know that name. Refresh my memory who he is. I know that name, but I'm drawing a blank right now.
So Travis Scott is the rapper, and I think he was involved with the Kardashians. I could be completely wrong about that. So this is Travis Scott here. He's known for Astroworld, and he has like this weird symbolism that he's known for this. The concert where a bunch of people died. You have the portal. Right. So again, very Kabbalistic, very demonic. He was gonna do the concert in Giza, and they ended up canceling it.
Weird.
Because supposedly the officials didn't agree with the religious views or something or other. But he's got some really, look at this. He's got almost like Crowley-esque here, like this cover here. You have the sun, you have the disc up here, and he also has some homunculus references too. He's got like some weird totems going on. Yeah. Again, very Kabbalistic, but you know, some people would say, oh, it's just symbolism, and other people would say, no, it's symbolism to control the masses. What's your take on these elites using this sort of symbolism in their work? Do you think they do it to be edgy? Do you think maybe they do it to invoke something, how we're seeing in these movies, Midsommar and Hereditary? What do you think the reasoning behind them using that sort of stuff? Or is it just, right, to tell a good story? But what a weird story to tell, and what a bizarre. And that's what I love about alchemy, because you'll just look at all these alchemical plates of what these guys were trying to portray back then, and it's like, were they really onto something? Did they really hold secrets, or were they just pulling everyone's leg and just drawing cool stuff? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. What's the whole thing behind it?
Well, I mean, I think again, my examination of this is, I don't think there's one answer. I think you have to look at it on a case by case study. You know, could this person be using it for this? Could this person be using it for that? I mean, you know, again, what you have said is all valid reasons. I mean, it could be a person is trying to manipulate the masses. He's trying to be provocative. It could be just, like you said, for show business, you know, to get people talking about it, to be provocative. Certainly in my books, I use little, you know, clues and hints and do things in my books that are codes and here and there. So, you know, I'm guilty of it also. Again, I just think it has to do with the artist. I think it has to do with the sophistication of the artist. I mean, I think some artists are much better at this than others. You know, to me, like in just going to movies, you know, I think, you know, someone like, you know, Stanley Kubrick, Darren Aronofsky, Aaron Astar, Alfred Hitchcock, David Lynch. I mean, these are people, you know, Spielberg, Lucas, Robert Zemeckis. These are people who are really adroit with this material, know what they're doing, you know, and are very, you know, experts with this. You know, I look at some other directors, not so much. Same thing with, you know, any other performer. I mean, I look at some musicians, filmmakers, you know, I mean, I think that there's a, you know, decidedly expert use of the occult when I look at what, like the Beatles, you know, or the Rolling Stones, you know, bands like that, you know, maybe even the Grateful Dead to an extent, that really sort of know what they're doing. I think people, maybe some of the rappers nowadays, you know, it's more just as a, you know, a shock value thing. That's kind of my take on it, but I don't think there's one answer. Again, my it's like a movie. You can't really, it's like symbolism in movies. You can't apply, at least in my experience, and the way I do it is, you know, I don't apply a blanket answer across the board. I look at each movie on its own, because what I have found is in some movies, a symbol or theme may mean this, but in something in another movie, it may mean this. And that makes sense in the world of symbolism. I mean, you know, symbols have multiple meanings. It depends on their context. So my answer is, yeah, I mean, it can be done for any variety of reasons, you know, and of course, attention getting is one. But yeah, I mean, could it be malignant? Sure. Could it be also positive? Of course. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just the creator's intent. I mean, there are some movies, I've mentioned this on other shows, that to me, I mean, what I describe is like the devil is in the celluloid, that are just very dark and very, you know, sinister. I mean, Midsommar is one of them. The Exorcist is another movie that I put in that category. And this may be a little surprising because it goes back in time, is The Black Cat with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, a very dark movie for 1934, 32, wherever it was. You know, I mean, this is a movie that deals with necrophilia, Satanism. The Karloff character is clearly a Crowley stand-in. So, you know, again, a very, very dark movie there. But, you know, again, I look at each thing on its own and take it from there.
This one right here, 1935?
No, that's The Black Room. We want to go to The Black Cat.
Whoops. The Black Cat.
And I think it's 34. It's the one with... 34. Yeah, there it is. 34. There you go. That's the one. Yep, that's it.
The Black Room. I've ever seen that one.
You know, I haven't. I haven't seen it. So it looks pretty good, though. It
says Embraced by the Devil. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, got to check that one out. Good grief.
1935, ignoring an ancient prophecy, evil brother Gregor seeks to maintain his feudal power on his Tyrolean estate by murdering and impersonating his benevolent younger twin. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So
I haven't seen that one.
What are your thoughts on these movies that get banned from certain countries for being too dark, right? And I've always talked about how cinema in particular, I mean, nowadays you have... Are you going to do a decode on the Squid Games at all?
You know, I've never watched an episode of the Squid Games. The problem with TV shows is it's just so time consuming. Yeah. It's just so time consuming. I mean, one of the things I took on in CS3 was Twin Peaks. I mean, and it took me all summer. I mean, it literally took me 3-4 months to do this because I had to sit down, watch all the episodes, which I did. Then I had to watch the movie, which I did. And then
Don't spoil it for me because I have to watch it. I keep hearing...
Oh, I won't.
I have colleagues who keep telling me about it. And they're like, hey, you know, you got to check this out. I got you. It's super, super good. And I got to get into it. But I hear it's a grind.
If you're going to watch Twin Peaks, I mean, be prepared to set some serious time aside because you have 2 seasons of the TV show. Then you have a movie, and then you have another TV show. There's one that came out about 4 or 5 years ago called The Return, I think, which was on Showtime. So, yeah, I mean, it's time consuming, to say the least. So to be honest with you, I do somewhat sidestep TV shows a lot of the time. I have done them. I did all the Twin Peaks, and I did all the Bates Motel from A&E. So I have taken one. Sometimes I reference just an episode. I've done that, of course, with The Simpsons. I've done that with The X-Files, of course. So I have cited just individual television shows. Oh, and the one that I'm doing in Cinema Symbolism 4, my God. There's this old TV show called from the early 60s called Route 66. And there's about 4 episodes in there that predict the Kennedy assassination right on the money. And the one that really nails it also has a lot of 9/11 references in it. So that's interesting. So, you know, I do take on television shows, but, you know, it is what it is. It's a arduous study.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I can relate because, I mean, I'm always doing research for my show and different things. So most definitely, I mean... But again, the whole cinema thing, you could watch it, it's there. So there's definitely no shortage of things to decode. That's for sure, right? You'll be busy for a while. And
Oh, no. Yeah.
You keep mentioning JFK. You mentioned earlier how, and also you said 77 and 42, well, A24, right? 42 there. You got the 2 and the 4, which is interesting. And the Kennedy assassination. And I know you had something on the missing brain of JFK, which I've never heard about, but that piqued my interest.
Well, like for example, I mean, I'll just get into this briefly. with JFK, what I basically said, you know, in the novel, or in Cinema Symbolism 4, which I'm writing, not a novel, is essentially, you know, Dealey Plaza, Camelot got turned into the Land of Oz. I'd have to pull it up, but you know, the name, hang on, let me just do this real fast. So I know what I'm talking about here. Give me 1 second here.
Good. Yeah, yeah. That jumped out to me when you said I'm missing Brown. I'm like, I mean.
So here, let me just give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about with this killing curse, just so people have a brief idea. So the name Lee Harvey Oswald in reverse Pythagorean reduction has a value of 77. The Zapruder frame that shows Kennedy's headshot is frame 313, which is, of course, 3 plus 1 plus 3 is 7. Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot Kennedy from a 7-story building. That's the book's cool book depository. Of course, this is the Land of Oswald, Oz, the Wizard of Oz, of course, Oswald, O-Z, not O-S, Mr. 77. And of course, Kennedy had his brains blown out approaching Route 77. So this is how this curse manifests. Of course, it kills his brother, Robert Kennedy, I'd have to pull this up, but give me a minute here.
Because there's a curse also associated with that family too, because they've all seemed to.
No, but this is the Wizard of Oz. I'll tell you exactly. Hang on 1 sec, because this one's hard to believe, even for me.
It's all just a coincidence, Robert. I'm sure of it. I can hear the people.
Oh, well, this is a coincidence. This is the greatest string of coincidences I've ever seen. Right. Bobby Kennedy was born on November 20th, 1925. That date has a Pythagorean reduced value of 77. He was killed at age 42, which is, of course, the Dark Mother. And he was killed in the Ambassador Hotel. And if you don't know, the Ambassador Hotel was where, in 1940, the Wizard of Oz lost to the Gone with the Wind Best Oscar. So there's our little mocking Wizard of Oz reference. The other brother, Teddy Kennedy, was killed on August 25th. Died on August 25th, 2009, at age 77. And August 25th, 2009, is the 70th anniversary of the theatrical release of The Wizard of Oz. So you can see how this thing moves around and how this number, this kill number, turns up with these people. And again, we find the same thing at Columbine. We find the same thing at the Murrah Building. We can find the same thing at 9/11. We find the same thing. I mean, it's all over the place when you start breaking this stuff down. Those numbers are just all over the place. I mean, hang on. I'll give you a couple more examples here. Flight. What is it? Oh, hang on. I gotta open this up.
And also, I want to point out that our friend Lyman Frank Baum, is that how you say his name?
Lyman Frank Baum, that's it.
He died May 6, 1919, so you have the 9/11 there as well in the 1919, which is interesting.
I mean, here's a couple for you. I mean, I won't go too far with this. I mean, here's some of the things. I mean, I don't think this can be implanted by human beings. The first plane on 9/11, Flight 11, hit the North Tower at 8:46 a.m. The last plane at Shanksville crashed at 10:03 a.m. That's 77 minutes later. Here's a good one. This is another one of Crowley's numbers. Flight 11 departed Logan International Airport on runway 4R. 4R. R is the 18th letter of the alphabet. That's 418.
Yeah.
If you read Crowley, that's the number of abracadabra. Mm. 418. That's the magic word of the new age of Horus. The date 11th. The two words 11th September has a value of 77. Let me see here. Let me.
418 is important. That's an important. That's one the word that's going to usher in the. And I've talked about that before. And supposedly he told everybody that he got in touch with Iowa's on April 18th. And then it turns out that it was actually on April 1st, April Fool's. So I don't know. And that's quoting Grant, Kenneth Grant, that obviously.
Yeah, he contacted him. It was the early days of August, or excuse me, April of 04. One second here. Give me a second. I'm just scanning this document as fast as I can. Flight 77. This is the flight 77 out of Dulles departed at 8:20 a.m. and it crashed into the 77-foot-tall, seven-story Pentagon 77 minutes later at 9:37 a.m., which is 577 minutes into the day.
Interesting.
There's a good 77 for you on 9/11. And of course, one of the flights struck the 77th floor of the World Trade Center. Another number that's critical to Crowley that that turns up on 9/11 all over the place, and this is the number of AWOS, the messenger, is 93. That's a number that manifests not once, not twice, but six times on 9/11 is the number 93. Hang on, let me see if I can't pull that up for you real fast.
And have you documented any current day events, like current events that have happened, like the Maui fires or anything? Does that have any?
You know, there probably is, but I haven't. Hang on one second. Let me pull this up. I haven't looked at it. I haven't applied the numbers to it. I'd have to look at it. But it could. It could. It certainly could. Hang on. Let me. Where the hell is? No, that's not it.
Looking here to see if I because I have a.
Yeah, the number 93 strikes. This is the number 93 in Crowley is the number of AWOS, and in Greek gematria, 93 is the value of do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. That's the, you know, maxim of the New Age of Horus. The number 93 appears six times on 9/11. Of course, we have Flight 93. That's the easy one. The two flights that hit the two towers is flight 175 and 11. If you add them together, you get 186, which is 93 plus 93. Flight 175 hit the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. You drop the 0:93. And there was of all the deaths of the two, whatever it was, the nearly 3,000 deaths were from 93 different countries. So, you know, right. There's your 93.
Yeah.
You know, for that, the thing is overloaded. The 42 is very well concealed. The coordinates. Hang on one second. Let me see if I can't find this. Put on, just so people have an idea of what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. I don't want to come on and say this stuff. And here, the World Trade Center coordinates. The old World Trade Center coordinates, this is interesting, is north is 40, 42, 42. So there's your Dark Mother twice because you have two towers. 40 is 4 plus 0 or 4. That's the weapon of the evil magician. So we had four aircraft. Then its westerly coordinates are 74, 0, 0, 45. 7, 4 is 11, 0, 0 is nothing, and 4, 5 is 9 for 9/11 backwards. So there's your Dark Mother hiding there at 42. Flight 93, this is the one that crashed in Shanksville, was delayed 42 minutes on the runway. And Flight 11, when it struck the Pentagon, came in at a 42-degree angle. So that's where the Dark Mother hides. She's hard to pin down. That kill number, that 42 kill number is always hard to find in these things. Sometimes it stares you right in the face. For example, let me pull this up real fast. So again, people have an idea. This one is always an interesting one. I always found was we go to Columbine. Columbine. Let me pull this up. Columbine. This is the shooting of Klebold and Harris. And Klebold was born on 9/11/81. That's 20 years beforehand. So let's see here. Columbine, I spelled it wrong. So Columbine, the date of the shooting, April 20th, 1999, has a value of 77 in Pythagorean reduction. The massacre of Klebold and Harris lasted from 11:19 a.m. to 12:08 p.m. That's 49 minutes. That's 7 squared, 7. And the movie that inspired them to kill was, oh, I may not have that here, was Natural Born Killers. That movie was released, and this is, again, this is this numeric timing sequence, was released on August 26th, 1994. That's 55 years and a day after The Wizard of Oz opened in cinemas. And again, this is the mocking Wizard of Oz reference. That's exactly 20,090 days, which is 7 times 2,870 or 7 times 287. So again, this thing always moves around in these numbers of 7 and 70 or 7, 7, 70, 7. That's always the way this moves around in. From August 25th, 1939 to the date of the Columbine Massacre, which is August 26th, 1990, which was when Natural Born Killers was released. This is the movie that inspired them. That was released on August 26th, 1984. That's also 2,870 weeks, which is 7 times 410 or 70 times 41. So again, this is all being shifting around based on the number 7 is how this thing moves around. Crazy stuff. The T-shirts that they wore, Klebold wore a T-shirt. Hang on, let me pull this up. So again, people have an idea of what I'm talking about here. I just don't want people thinking I'm just pulling this out. I know Klebold had a black T-shirt on that had the word Wrath printed on it. That has an ordinal value of 70. In base gematria. Natural Selection was what was on Harris's shirt, and that has a value of 189, and that's 7 times 27. So again, the number 7 all over the place. One of the ones that's another one we can turn to is Sandy Hook, of course. Let me pull this one up. Sandy Hook was what inspired Lanza. This is the shooter at Sandy Hook, was a guy in Norway named Anders Behring Breivik. And he went on a killing rampage on July 22nd, 2011.
Was on the mosque?
No, that's the guy. I get into him too, but this is Breivik. This is the Norway shooter. And he attacked on July 22nd, 2011. July is, of course, the seventh month. And, of course, 2211, those are double numbers. That's what's called the dyad in Crowley's system. Those are ill numbers. Those are bad numbers. Anders killed 77 people. And that inspired Lanza to go on his killing rampage at Sandy Hook. He said he was trying to beat his high score. He viewed the whole thing as a video game. He killed 26 people and he wounded 2, which is 26 plus 2 is 28. That's 7 times 4. Lanza's birthday is April 22nd, 1992. That has a sum of 77 in gematria using Pythagorean reduction. And when he was in Sandy Hook, he squeezed off exactly 154 rounds. That's 77 times 2, or 77, 77. So again, these are just, numbers all over the place. The one that was interesting was with Columbine. Let me just jump back to there real fast. This one was really difficult for me to uncover because this one was staring me in the face. I did all sorts of research into Columbine looking for this number 42, the Dark Mother. This is, again, Crowley's kill number, and this walks hand in hand with 77. She's like the Dark Mother, sort of like the dark satanic force behind 77. I searched high and low for 42, for that number in Columbine. I looked everywhere for it. I could not find it anywhere. I searched high and low for it, and lo and behold, it was staring me in the face the entire time. And of course, 42 is the date. April is the fourth month and the 20th. 2 plus 0 is 2, 42. So there she is hiding right in plain sight.
420 is also with Crowley, with the, it was supposedly part of the Amalantra, I forgot how to say it, the workings that he got in touch with Lamb through. It was a series of workings, and on 420 they documented that they were taking hashish or something like that, he writes in his journals. And so Crowley said that 33 is not a good number in the Aeon of Horus. Now,
it's the kill number.
33. He said that it was no good in his system, right?
He doesn't address it at all. He does not address 33. The closest you'll get to is 3 and 333. And you will get the 333, which is the demon Corazon.
Yeah.
That's the demon Corazon is his number. Yeah, and what's interesting about Corazon is with 333 is this is the demon that apparently took control of Victor Newberg out in the deserts of Africa. This was you know, the dweller of the abyss. What and this ties into the Wizard of Oz killing curse is if you look at the man who made the ruby slippers, there were four sets of them. Then if you read Crowley's numbers, four is the number of the evil magician's weapons. There were four sets of ruby slippers made for the Wizard of Oz. And the man who made them was a man who went by his last name. His name was Adrian, very famous MGM costume designer. He's one of the most famous. And his birth date is March 3rd, 03 for 333, of all things. So I always found that interesting. This is probably one of the ways this curse worked its way into the ruby slippers. Ruby always turns up in all these things, by the way. I mean, in Columbine, the name of the school, is a flower, a heirloom Columbine. And its most famous one is the Ruby Port. Again, this is an allusion to the ruby slippers. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald is done in by the ruby slippers, or Jack Ruby. So
the reason I bring up 33, because it's tied to JFK, to segue back to JFK, because I've always heard people talk about that was a King Kill 33 ritual.
And no.
You don't agree with that, the King Kill 33?
No, I don't buy into any of that stuff with Kennedy. Kennedy was a secret society man. He was in a secret society known as the Knights of Columbus. So all that talk about, you know, secret societies by him, that's all hypocritical talk. He's one of them.
And what happened to his brain? Is there something occult with that? Did they take it and start worshiping it, or what?
No, it was. This was a story that was related to me by a Kennedy insider. I've been on other shows about this. It's been a while since I talked about it. It's a good talking point. I will say to you and your audience that everything I'm about to say, and I say this as a lawyer, is hearsay. I have no documented evidence other than this. Someone told me a story, but the person that told me the story, I believed, and it does make sense. And again, it's hearsay testimony. I have no firsthand knowledge of this. If you've ever watched the movie JFK with, or let me close this out real fast. If you ever watched the movie JFK with Oliver Stone, there's a scene in it where they tried to subpoena the brain as evidence to try to find out where the trajectory of the bullet, where it came from. And of course, the brain is missing. No one knows where it is. Years ago, I'm not going to identify the person other than to say that he or she is no longer alive. I was talking to this person. Again, this is many, many moons ago. And somehow or another, in a conversation, this person was a Kennedy insider. Kennedy's JFK's missing brain got brought up. And this person said, I know where it is. And this person related a story to me, which I will be more than happy to share with you and the audience. And again, just to reiterate, this is hearsay testimony. This is just what I was told, but I believe the story. The story goes, and this is true, this part is true, that when Kennedy was at Bethesda and they did the autopsy on him, his brain was removed. That's true. And it was kept at the National Archives. That's also true. It was actually evidence of the murder. It was, you know, the trajectory of the bullet. I have no knowledge of how the brain was stored. I presume logic tells me it was kept in a jar, probably in formaldehyde or some sort of, you know, preserving agent of some kind. And of course, when Garrison, years later, when he was trying Clay Shaw, I believe in 68, 69, he subpoenaed the National Archives to get the brain, and lo and behold, it was gone. The story that was told to me, and again, I have no right reason to dispute it, but I can't prove it either, was that in 1967, and this is true, Kennedy's body was moved in Arlington. It was moved to where it is now. It was moved about 20 feet from where it was originally interred in 1963, and it was moved to a more advantageous location right under the house, Robert E. Lee's old mansion, overlooking Washington, D.C., with the torch burning on it. So it was moved about 20 feet. And the story that I was told was that when the body was being moved, The Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, went into the National Archives and removed the brain and buried it with his brother, put it in his brother's coffin and buried it. The reason for that was, his motivation was, he was deadly afraid that the brain was going to fall into the hands of some sort of carnival barker or sideshow and become part of a freak show. And he was deathly terrified of that. So he wanted it gone. So he buried it with John F. Kennedy's body. Again, I did not witness this. I have no firsthand knowledge of this. This was told to me by someone I trust, that I would describe to you and your audience as a Kennedy insider. I have no reason to dispute the story. I can't prove it otherwise, but that's my understanding of where Kennedy's brain was. I was on a show, it was Coast to Coast AM, about 6 or 7 months ago, and a caller came in. I told the story there, and a caller called in and made a great point of this. And one of the things, so someone said, look, the point was raised. They said, wouldn't RFK, who believed that there was a conspiracy involved, wouldn't he have wanted to keep the brain as evidence to show that the shot came from the front and not behind? And I said, huh, I never thought of that. And then another caller came in and said, no. They said the brain, within about 2 years after being kept in, even the most hardcore preserving agents would have turned to liquid. By about 1965, 66, the brain would have, been liquefied, and it would have been impossible anyway. So that made sense to me. And again, the story was that Robert Kennedy took it in 1967 from the archives, probably didn't have permission, tried an inside job, and buried it with his brother when it was moved in Arlington. That's the story of where I understand John F. Kennedy's brain is. Again, it's hearsay. I have no firsthand knowledge of this, but it was related to me by someone I trust, and I have no reason to dispute the story.
Yeah, I'd never even, I just looked this up now, I'd never even have heard about this, about the missing brain of, so yeah, in 66, was found to be missing from the National Archives. And then it goes, conspiracy theorists often claim that the brain may have shown a bullet from the front. It has also suggested that Robert Kennedy destroyed the brain. What an interesting turn of events. Again, I've never dived too deep into the whole JFK thing. And again, that's why I didn't know about this. But the idea of them wanting to hide something, and it would be with that, right? I mean, that would tell the full story, I guess. That would be the smoking gun, no pun intended, that would put all these other theories to rest, and the second shooter and all these different things, that would be it, that brain. But that's long gone now.
Yeah. And if the brain was liquefied, it would be impossible to identify anything anyway. The story was that Kennedy, RFK, didn't want it in the hands of a collector or a sideshow, yeah, or in a freak show. So, I mean, he had motivation to do this. And again, that's the story that was told to me, believe it or not, whatever. But, I have no reason to disbelieve it.
Yeah. And I that would make sense. I like to think that maybe somebody took it and started to do some occult stuff with it. Right. I mean, you have the whole skull and bones and what they do with different, you have different,
yeah, they've got, who do they have? They've got Geronimo, Martin Van Buren, and Pancho Villa is the story with Skull and Bones, I believe.
Martin Van Buren, really?
Martin Van Buren, one of the presidents, yeah, they've got his skull, allegedly, Pancho Villa, and Geronimo. And of course, Geronimo's was allegedly stolen by Prescott Bush, which is George Bush 41's father and W's grandfather. All of them were Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
And that one, that conspiracy had some good legs to it. There is a lot of strong evidence to suggest that that is an Illuminati lodge, or is at least the continuation of the old Bavarian Illuminati of Weishaupt. Yes. I mean, there is some very pervasive, persuasive evidence of that. And that does seem to be, has legs to it, no question.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that, again, back to this magically charged thing, and you also have beliefs that, as you mentioned, the goat of Mendez earlier, you got Baphomet, and the idea of the Knights Templar had the head of John the Baptist. You have all these talismans that they keep, again, to do Lord knows what, to prophesize to them, to do whatever they think that they're extracting magical essence from it. And yeah, no, most definitely. I think that these, and the issue is, I always tell people, you know, this is all very bizarre to hear about. This is all very alarming. This could, it's unsettling, but think about it. The idea that secret societies exist. I mean, you're a Freemason, right, Robert? You're sure, part of a lodge. The idea that that concept is a thing. I mean, you know, there's actual organizations out there of people who get together. Oh, yeah. Now, what they do behind closed doors, that's up that's where the conspiracies come from. But yes, these are real things, and they have their own sets of beliefs that they
absolutely. I mean, I always tell people, you know, as a lawyer, you know, conspiracy is a criminal charge. It's a real thing. You can be charged as being part of a conspiracy. It might be a little hard to prove, mm-hmm. but it is an actual, you know, criminal charge, you know, on the books, you know, on Maryland statutes, you know, or whatever state you live in, mm-hmm. you know, or even federally, you know, there is a criminal charge of conspiracy. So they do exist. If they didn't exist, there would be no criminal charge. And again, you know, with Freemasonry, I've been in it. I just got the flyer. I just got the communication email to me a couple of days ago, actually, from my lodge. And I don't know if you're aware of this. Lodges, Masonic lodges, it's what's called going dark. In the summer months, they don't meet because it goes back to the day. There was no air conditioning in the lodges, and they became too hot. In the summer months. So Masonic lodges never met in July and August. They would pick up, they'd basically end in the middle, around the middle of June, and pick up around the beginning of September. And that continues on to this day. It's called going dark. And I just got the communique for my lodge emailed to me. We do it by email now, of course. And I am coming up in September will be my 26th anniversary of being a member of the lodge. I couldn't believe it. It's like, where does the time go? Good grief. But yeah, I mean, I've been involved with Freemasonry now for, you know, 26 years. Over that, actually, if you go when I go back to the Entered Apprentice degrees, you know, to when I first, you know, 27, you know, when I first started petitioning it. And yeah, I mean, it's Freemasonry without question, you know, incorporates a lot of mystical aspects. I mean, you have things related to alchemy and Gnosticism and magic. And, you know, necromancy even, you know, and you get the retelling of the, you know, dying and resurrected solar god man, Osiris, Egypt's Orpheus. You know, that's all present there. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very esoteric ritual, at least. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the order used to have much more of an, you know, the brotherhood, the lodge used to have much more of a occult flair to it. That's really kind of washed away in the 1820s. But yeah, I mean, I've been involved with it for 26 years. And, you know, even now, I mean, I wrote, you know, a book about it, The Royal Arch of Enoch. I mean, I think a lot of the rituals and the philosophies, you know, are very mystical and occult and esoteric. I mean, I think that's, you know, pretty irrefutable.
Yeah, next time you come on, Robert, I want to talk to you about that, because that was actually the first book I found that, you know, of yours that I found, that I came across, the Royal Arch Freemasonry, which I find super interesting. So next time we can talk about that. Do you have any closing thoughts on maybe where you think this is all going? Do you think this numerical parasitic killing hex is going to continue its rampage? Should we, I know you alluded to some predictions coming up here soon, but is there anything else you want to leave the people with before we sign off?
Yeah, sure. Well, for starters, I want to thank you, Juan, for having me on the One-on-One podcast. It was my pleasure to be here, and it was a terrific show. I'd be more than welcome to, you know, more than happy to come back again. And again, thank you for having me on. Just briefly, if you want to find out more about me and where to buy my books, just go to my website, which is my name, which is Robert W. Sullivan IV. My website is robertwsullivaniv.com. There's links there to purchase the books on all the major online sites. Information about me, shows that I've been on, the show will be posted there when it goes live, you know, on YouTube or Spotify or whatever. I will put a link up. My biography is there. Again, you know, shows that I'm going to be on. I have a blog that I update routinely with information, you know, research, upcoming shows. So check out the website, www.robertwsullivaniv.com. One of the things that makes this thing so hard to track is, again, is you're dealing with sequences related to the number 7 and 77. And things like that. So, I mean, you know, you don't know if you're 14 weeks out or 14 years out, you know, or 7 weeks out or 7 days out. That's what sort of, you know, to be fair, that what does what makes this a little hard to track down. The only thing I would say is, you know, I don't wish anyone any harm. I'd say keep an eye on Sandra Bullock, Taylor Swift. I'd kind of keep a raised eyebrow on. I've run some numbers on this and some, you know, little Pythagorean mathematics, maybe a little Kabbalistic magic. I would say keep an eye out for the date, for the 7 day period of June of 2026, spanning from about the 14th to the 21st. If I understand this death, I mean, nothing may happen. I don't know. But I think based on what I know about this thing, I think that's a time frame this thing will find irresistible. And I can't see this thing staying away from that 7 day period in June of 2026. That's when I would say this thing could rear its ugly head again. I don't know what it will be. I'd be speculating. Nothing could happen. Nothing at all could happen. But I would say keep an eye out for a natural disaster, you know, a school shooting, a 9/11 type thing. That would be a time frame right now I would keep an eyeball on.
And when can we expect the next book, Robert?
Yeah, the book I'm writing right now is CS4. I'm also making some edits to the Royal Arch and some of my other books. That will be a third edition on that one. Cinema Symbolism 4, to be honest, is probably at least a year and a half away. The one movie that I am sitting on and I will not make a move on until I watch it is not coming out until October of next year. And this is, of course, Joker 2. The first Joker movie is over the top with all kind of themes in it. That's a very alchemical movie, by the way. If you're interested in what I was talking about earlier with alchemical symbolism, take a look at Joker with Joaquin Phoenix, the first one. So I got to imagine that Joker 2, and even from the little bit I've seen of it with Lady Gaga and with him, this again looks to be a very alchemical movie. So I'm going to want to watch that. That's going to go in Cinema Symbolism 4. So unfortunately, that doesn't come out till October of next year. So Cinema Symbolism 4, right now, let's see, that's 2024. I'm probably targeting the spring of 2025 for Cinema Symbolism 4. Somewhere in there also will be a new edition of Royal Arch. Cinema Symbolism 1 will get a third edition, and CS2 will get a second edition. Those are probably 2, 3, 4 years away. And again, you know, be trying to do some fiction in there as well. But yeah, Cinema Symbolism 4, again, the book kind of went off into a different direction with this Wizard of Oz, you know, 7742 thing. But it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And like I said, the most interesting thing is this latent Wizard of Oz macabre, morbid reference in there that will inevitably turn up. So fascinating study.
Awesome. Well, Robert, I appreciate you coming on. This was fun. And we'll do it again soon, man. And as always, everyone.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Juan.
See you on the other side.
Heartbeat. sadistic scene. Trouble.